Please. I thought you said you weren't going to argue. Maria looked away. You never used to talk like this. You're the one who always told me that copies had to be treated exactly like human beings. If you hadn't been brainwashed by that religion. The Church of the God who makes no difference has no position on copies, one way or the other. It has no position on anything. That's right. So it can hardly be their fault that I don't want to be scanned, can it? Maria felt physically sick. She'd held off saying anything on the subject for almost a year. She'd been astonished and appalled, but she'd struggled to respect her mother's choice. And now she could see that that had been insane, irresponsible beyond belief. You don't stand by and let someone you love, someone who gave you your own understanding of the world, have their brain turned to pulp. She said, "It's their fault because they've undermined your judgment. They've fed you so much bullshit that you can't think straight about anything anymore." Francesca just looked at her reprovingly. Maria felt a pang of guilt. How can you make things harder for her now? How can you start attacking her when she's just told you that she's dying? But she wasn't going to fold now, take the easy way out, be supportive. She said, "God makes no difference because God is the reason why everything is exactly what it is? That's supposed to make us all feel at peace with the cosmos, is it?" Francesca shook her head. "At peace? No. It's just a matter of clearing away, once and for all, old ideas like divine intervention and the need for some kind of proof or even faith in order to believe." Maria said, "What do you need then? I don't believe, so what am I missing?" "Belief. And a love of tautology." "Don't knock tautology. Better to base a religion on tautology than fantasy." "But it's worse than tautology. It's redefining words arbitrarily. It's like something out of Lewis Carroll or George Orwell." "God is the reason for everything, whatever that reason is. So what any sane person would simply call the laws of physics, you've decided to rename G-O-D, solely because the word carries all kinds of historical resonances, all kinds of misleading connotations. You claim to have nothing to do with the old religions, so why keep using their terminology?" Francesca said, "We don't deny the history of the word. We make a break from the past in a lot of ways. But we also acknowledge our origins. God is a concept people have been using for millennia. The fact that we've refined the idea beyond primitive superstitions and wish fulfillment doesn't mean we're not part of the same tradition." "But you haven't refined the idea. You've made it meaningless, and rightly so, but you don't seem to realize it. You've stripped away all the obvious stupidities, all the anthropomorphism, the miracles, the answered prayers, but you don't seem to have noticed that once you've done that, there's absolutely nothing left that needs to be called religion. Physics is not theology. Ethics is not theology. Why pretend that they are?" Francesca said, "But don't you see? We talk about God for the simple reason that we still want to. There's a deeply ingrained human compulsion to keep using that word, that concept, to keep honing it, rather than discarding it, despite the fact that it no longer means what it did 5,000 years ago. And you know perfectly well where that compulsion comes from. It has nothing to do with any real divine being. It's just a product of culture and neurobiology, a few accidents of evolution and history." "Of course it is. What human trait isn't? So why give in to it?" Francesca laughed. "Why give in to anything? The religious impulse isn't some kind of alien mind virus. It's not, in its purest form, stripped of all content, the product of brainwashing. It's a part of who I am." Maria put her face in her hands. "Is it? When you talk like this, it doesn't sound like you." Francesca said, "Don't you ever want to give thanks to God when things are going well for you? Don't you ever want to ask God for strength when you need it?"
"No."
Well, I do, even though I know God makes no difference. And if God is the reason for everything, then God includes the urge to use the word God. So whenever I gain some strength or comfort or meaning from that urge, then God is the source of that strength, that comfort, that meaning. And if God, while making no difference, helps me to accept what's going to happen to me, why should that make you sad? On the train home, Maria sat next to a boy of about 7 who twitched all the way to the silent rhythms of a nerve-induced PMV, participatory music video. Nerve induction had been developed to treat epilepsy, but now its most common use seemed to bring about the symptoms it was meant to alleviate. Glancing at him sideways, she could see his eyeballs fluttering behind his mirror shades. As the shock of the news diminished slightly, Maria began to see things more clearly. It was really all about money, not religion. She wants to be a martyr, to save me from spending a cent. All the rest is rationalization. She must have picked up a load of archaic bullshit from her own parents about the virtues of not being a burden, not imposing too much on the next generation, not ruining the best years of their lives. She'd left her cycle in a locker at Central Station. She rode home slowly through the leisurely Sunday evening traffic, still feeling drained and shaky, but a little more confident now that she'd had a chance to think it through. 12 to 18 months. She'd raise the money in less than a year. Somehow. She'd show Francesca that she could shoulder the burden, and once that was done, her mother could stop inventing excuses. Home, she started some vegetables boiling, then went upstairs and checked for mail. There were 6 items under junk, 4 under Autoverse, and nothing under boring but lucrative. Since her letter in Autoverse review, almost every subscriber had been in touch, with congratulations, requests for more data, offers of collaboration, and a few borderline crank calls full of misunderstandings and complaints. Her success with A. Lamberti had even made the big time. A slightly less specialized journal, Cellular Automaton World. It was all strangely anticlimactic, and in a way she was glad of that. It put things in perspective. She trashed all the junk mail with a sweep of her hand across the touchscreen, then sat for a moment gazing at the icons for the Autoverse messages, contemplating doing the same to them. I have to get my act together, concentrate on earning money, and stop wasting time on this shit. She ran the first message. A teenage girl in Kansas City complained that she couldn't duplicate Maria's results and proceeded to describe her own torturous version of the experiment. Maria stopped and deleted the file after viewing 20 seconds. She'd already replied at length to 6 like it, and any sense of obligation she'd felt to the Autoverse community had vanished in the process. As she started the second message running, she smelled something burning downstairs and suddenly remembered that the stove had been brain dead since Friday. Everything had to be watched, and she couldn't even switch off the hot plates remotely. She turned up the volume on the terminal and headed for the kitchen. The spinach was a blackened mess. She threw the saucepan across the narrow room. It rebounded almost to her feet. She picked it up again and started smashing it against the wall beside the stove until the tiles began to crack and fall to the floor. Damaging the house was more satisfying than she'd ever imagined. It felt like rending her clothes, like tearing out her hair, like self-mutilation. She pounded the wall relentlessly until she was breathless, giddy, running with sweat, her face flushed with a strange heat she hadn't felt since childhood tantrums. Her mother touched her cheek with the back of her hand, brushing away tears of anger. The cool skin, the wedding ring.
Shh. Look at the state you're in. You're burning up.
After a while, she calmed down and noticed that the message was still playing upstairs. The sender must have programmed it to repeat indefinitely until she acknowledged it. She sat on the floor and listened. My name is Paul Durham. I read your article in Autoverse Review. I was very impressed by what you've done with A. Lamberti, and if you think you might be interested in being funded to take it further, call me back on this number, and we can talk about it. Maria had to listen 3 more times before she was certain she'd understood the message. Being funded to take it further. The phrasing seemed deliberately coy and ambiguous, but in the end, it could only really mean one thing. Some idiot was offering her a job. When Durham asked to meet her in person, Maria was too surprised to do anything but agree. Durham said he lived in North Sydney and suggested that they meet the next morning in the city at the Market Street Cafe. Maria, unable to think of a plausible excuse on the spot, just nodded, thankful that she'd made the call through a software filter which would erase any trace of anxiety from her face and tone of voice. Most programming contracts did not involve interviews, even by phone. The tendering process was usually fully automated, based entirely on the quote submitted, and the tenderer's audited performance record. Maria hadn't faced an interview in the flesh since she'd applied for part-time cleaning jobs as a student. It was only after she'd broken the connection that she realized she still had no idea what Durham wanted from her. A real Autoverse fanatic might, just conceivably, part with money for the privilege of collaborating with her, perhaps footing the bills for computer time for the sake of sharing the kudos of any further results. It was hard to think of any other explanation. Maria lay awake half the night, looking back on the brief conversation, wondering if she was missing something blindingly obvious, wondering if it could be some kind of hoax. Just before 2, she got up and did a hasty literature search of Autoverse Review and a handful of other cellular automaton journals. There were no articles by anyone named Durham. Around 3 o'clock, she gave up pondering the question and managed to force herself to sleep. She dreamt that she was still awake, distraught at the news of her mother's illness, and then realizing that she was only dreaming, cursed herself angrily, because this proof of her love was nothing but an illusion. Chapter 8. Remit Not Paucity. November 2050. Thomas took the elevator from his office to his home. In life, the journey had been a 10-minute ride on the S-Bahn, but after almost 4 subjective months, he was gradually becoming accustomed to the shortcut. Today, he began the ascent without giving it a second thought, admiring the oak paneling, lulled by the faint hum of the motor. But halfway up, for no good reason, he suffered a moment of vertigo, as if the elegant coffin had gone into freefall. When first resurrected, he'd worried constantly over which aspects of his past he should imitate for the sake of sanity, and which he should discard as a matter of honesty. A window with a view of the city seemed harmless enough, but to walk and ride through an artificial crowd scene struck him as grotesque, and the few times he'd tried it, he'd found it acutely distressing. It was too much like life, and too much like his dream of one day being among people again. He had no doubt that he would have become desensitized to the illusion with time, but he didn't want that. When he finally inhabited a telepresence robot as lifelike as his lost body, when he finally rode a real train again and walked down a real street, he didn't want the joy of the experience dulled by years of perfect imitation. He had no wish to delude himself, but apart from declining to mimic his corporeal life to the point of parody, it was hard to define exactly what that meant. He balked at the prospect of the nearest door always opening magically onto his chosen destination, and he had no desire to snap his fingers and teleport. Acknowledging and exploiting the unlimited plasticity of virtual reality might have been the most honest thing to do. But Thomas needed a world with a permanent structure, not a dream city which reconfigured itself to his every whim. Eventually, he'd found a compromise. He'd constructed an auxiliary geography or architecture for his private version of Frankfurt,
an alternative topology for the city, in which all the buildings he moved between were treated as being stacked one on top of the other, allowing a single elevator shaft to link them all. His house in the suburbs began 16 stories above his city office. In between were boardrooms, restaurants, galleries, and museums. Having decided upon the arrangement, he now regarded it as immutable, and if the view from each place, once he arrived, blatantly contradicted the relationship, he could live with that degree of paradox. Thomas stepped out of the elevator into the ground floor entrance hall of his home, the two-story building, set in a modest 10 hectares of garden. Was his alone, as the real-world original had been from the time of his divorce until his terminal illness when a medical team had moved in. At first he'd had cleaning robots gliding redundantly through the corridors and gardening robots at work in the flower beds, viewing them as part of the architecture, as much as the drain pipes, the air-conditioning grills, and countless other unnecessary fixtures. He'd banished the robots after the first week. The drain pipes remained. His dizziness had passed, but he strode into the library and poured himself a drink from 2 cut-glass decanters, a bracing mixture of confidence and optimism. With a word, he could have summoned up a full mood control panel, an apparition which always reminded him of a recording studio's mixing desk, and adjusted the parameters of his state of mind, until he reached a point where he no longer wished to change the settings, but he'd become disenchanted with that nakedly technological metaphor. Mood-altering drugs here could function with a precision and a lack of side effects which no real chemical could ever have achieved. Pharmacological accuracy was possible, but hardly mandatory, and it felt more natural to gulp down a mouthful of spirits for fortification than it did to make adjustments via a hovering bank of sliding potentiometers, even if the end result was exactly the same. Thomas sank into a chair as the drink started to take effect. As a matter of choice, it worked gradually, a pleasant warmth diffusing out from his stomach before his brain itself was gently manipulated and began trying to make sense of his encounter with Paul Durham. "You have to let me show you exactly what you are." There was a terminal beside the chair. He hit a button, and one of his personal assistants, Hans Lohr, appeared on the screen. Thomas said casually, "Find out what you can about my visitor, will you?" Lohr replied at once, "Yes, sir." Thomas had 6 assistants, on duty in shifts around the clock. All flesh-and-blood humans, but so thoroughly wired that they were able to switch their mental processes back and forth between normal speed and slowdown at will. Thomas kept them at a distance, communicating with them only by terminal. The distinction between a visitor in the flesh and a mere image on a screen didn't bear much scrutiny, but in practice it could still be rigorously enforced. He sometimes thought of his staff as working in Munich or Berlin, far enough away to explain the fact that he never met them in person, and yet near enough to make a kind of metaphorical sense of their ability to act as go-betweens with the outside world. He'd never bothered to find out where they really were, in case the facts contradicted this convenient mental image. He sighed and took another swig of C&O. It was a balancing act. A tightrope walk. A copy could go insane either way. Caring too much about the truth could lead to a pathological obsession with the infrastructure, the algorithms and optical processors, the machinery of deception which lay beneath every surface. Caring too little, you could find yourself gradually surrendering to a complacent fantasy in which life had gone on as normal, and everything which contradicted the illusion of ordinary physical existence was avoided, or explained away. Was that Durham's real intention? To drive him mad? Thomas had ordered the usual cursory screening before letting Durham in, revealing only that the man worked as a salesman for Griffin Financial Products,
a moderately successful Anglo-Australian company, and that he possessed no criminal record. Elaborate precautions were hardly warranted. Visitors could do no harm. Thomas's VR consultants had assured him that nothing short of tampering with the hardware in situ could ever damage or corrupt the system. No mere signal coming down the fiber from the outside world could penetrate the protected layers of the software. Visitors who wreaked havoc, introducing viruses by the fiendishly clever binary-modulated snapping of their fingers, were the stuff of fiction. Literally. Thomas had seen it happen once on the Unclear Family. Durham had said, "I'm not going to lie to you. I've spent time in a mental institution. 10 years. I suffered delusions. Bizarre, elaborate delusions. And I realize now that I was seriously ill. I can look back and understand that. But at the very same time, I can look back and remember what it was that I believed was happening when I was insane. And without for one moment ceasing to acknowledge my condition, I still find those memories so convincing." Thomas's skin crawled. He raised his glass and then put it down. He knew that if he kept on drinking, nothing the man had said would unsettle him in the least, but he hadn't drunk enough yet to be absolutely sure that that was what he wanted. "If you're not prepared to perform the experiment yourself, at least think about the implications. Imagine that you've modified the way in which you're computed, and imagine what the consequences would be." "A Gedanken experiment, is that too much to ask for? In a sense, that's all I ever performed myself." The terminal chimed. Thomas took the call. Lors said, "I have a preliminary report on Paul Durham. Would you like me to read it?" Thomas shook his head. "I'll view the file." He skimmed it, at level one detail. Paul Kingsley Durham. Born in Sydney on June 6, 2000. Parents, Elizabeth Ann Maddox and John Arthur Durham, joint owners of a delicatessen in the Sydney suburb of Concord from 1996 to 2032. Retired to Mackay, Queensland, now both deceased by natural causes. Educated at a government high school, 2017. Higher school certificate, aggregate score in third percentile. Best subjects, physics and mathematics. 2018. Completed 1 year of a science degree at Sydney University. Passed all examinations, but discontinued studies. 2019 to 2023. Traveled in Thailand, Burma, India, Nepal. 2024. On return to Australia, diagnosed with an organic delusional syndrome, probably congenital, condition partly controlled by medication. Numerous casual laboring jobs until May 2029. Condition deteriorating. Disability pension granted, January 2031. Committed to psychiatric ward of Blacktown Hospital on September 4, 2035. Corrective nanosurgery to the hippocampus and prefrontal cerebral cortex performed on November 11, 2045, declared a complete success. Thomas switched to level 2 to fill in the 10-year gap, but found little more than a long list of the drugs, neural grafts, and gene therapy vectors which had been injected into Durham's skull during that period, to no apparent benefit. There were frequent notes that the treatments had been tested first on a set of partial brain models, but hadn't worked in practice. Thomas wondered if Durham had been told about this, and wondered what the man imagined happened when a drug was evaluated on 15 separate models of different regions of the brain, which, taken together, encompassed the entire organ. 2046 to 2048. Studying finance and administration at Macquarie University. 2049. Graduated with first class honors and immediately hired by Griffin as a trainee salesman. As of January 17, 2050,
working in the Artificial Intelligence Division, which meant selling protection in various guises to copies who were afraid that their assets were going to be pulled out from under them. Durham's job description would certainly cover spending long hours as a visitor, if not quite stretching to matters like disclosing details of his personal psychiatric history or suggesting metaphysical Gedanken experiments to his clients, or indeed wasting time on copies obviously far too secure to need Griffin services. Thomas leaned back from the terminal. It was almost too simple. Durham had fooled his doctors into believing that they'd cured him, and then with typical paranoid ingenuity and tenacity, he'd set about getting himself into a position where he could meet copies, share the great truth that had been revealed to him, and try to extract a little money in the process. If Thomas contacted Griffin and told them what their mad salesman was up to, Durham would certainly lose his job, probably end up in an institution again, and hopefully benefit from a second attempt at nanosurgery. Durham probably wasn't harming anybody, but ensuring that he received treatment was surely the kindest thing to do. A confident, optimistic person would make the call at once. Thomas eyed his drink, but decided to hold off a little longer before drowning the alternatives. Durham had said, "I understand that everything I believe I've experienced was due to my illness, and I know there's no easy way to persuade you that I'm not still insane. But even if that were true, why should it make the questions I've raised any less important to you? Most flesh-and-blood humans live and die without knowing or caring what they are, scoffing at the very idea that it should matter. But you're not flesh-and-blood, and you can't afford the luxury of ignorance." Thomas rose and walked over to the mirror above the fireplace. Superficially, his appearance was still based largely on his final scan. He had the same unruly thick white hair, the same loose, mottled, translucent 85-year-old skin. He had the bearing of a young man, though. The model constructed from the scan file had been thoroughly rejuvenated, internally, sweeping away 60 years' worth of deterioration in every joint, every muscle, every vein and artery. He wondered if it was only a matter of time before vanity got the better of him, and he did the same with his appearance. Many of his business associates were unaging gradually, but a few had leaped back 20, 30, 50 years, or changed their appearances completely. Which was most honest, looking like an 85-year-old flesh-and-blood human, which he was not, or looking the way he'd prefer to look, prefer to be, given the choice, and he did have the choice. He closed his eyes, put his fingertips to his cheek, explored the damaged skin. If he believed these ruins defined him, they defined him, and if he learned to accept a new young body, the same would be true of it. And yet he couldn't shake the notion that external rejuvenation would entail nothing more than constructing a youthful mask, while his true face continued to exist and age somewhere. Pure Dorian Gray. A stupid moralistic fable stuffed with eternal verities long obsolete. And yet it was good just to feel healthy and vigorous, to be free of the arthritis, the aches and cramps and chills, the shortness of breath he could still remember vividly. Anything more seemed too easy, too arbitrary. Any copy could become a Hollywood Adonis in an instant. And any copy could outrace a bullet, lift a building, move a planet from its course. Thomas opened his eyes, reached out and touched the surface of the mirror, aware that he was avoiding making a decision. But one thing still bothered him. Why had Durham chosen him? The man might be deluded, but he was also intelligent and rational on some level. Of all the copies whose insecurities he might have tried to exploit, why choose one with a watertight setup, secure hardware, a well-managed trust fund? Why choose a target who appeared to have absolutely nothing to fear? Thomas felt the vertigo returning. It had been 65 years. Not one newspaper story or police report had mentioned his name. No database search, however elaborate, could link him to Anna. Nobody alive could know what he'd done, least of all a 50-year-old ex-psychiatric patient from the other side of the world. Even the man who'd committed the crime was dead. Thomas had seen him cremated. Did he seriously think that Durham's offer of sanctuary was some elaborately coded euphemism for not dredging up the past? Blackmail? No, that was ludicrous. So why not make a few calls and have the poor man seen to? Why not pay for him to be treated by the best Swiss neurosurgeon, who'd verify the procedure in advance on the most sophisticated set of partial brain models? Or did he believe there was a chance that Durham was telling the truth, that he could run a second copy in a place nobody could reach in a billion years? The terminal chimed. Thomas said, "Yes?" Heydrich had taken over from Lohr. Sometimes the shift seemed to change so fast that it made Thomas giddy.
"You have a meeting of the Geist Bank Board in 5 minutes, sir."
"Thank you. I'll be right down." Thomas checked his appearance in the mirror. He said, "Comb me." His hair was made passably tidy, his complexion less pale, his eyes clear. Certain facial muscles were relaxed, and others tightened. His suit required no attention. As in life, it could not be wrinkled. He almost laughed, but his newly combed expression discouraged it. Expediency, honesty, complacency, insanity. It was a tightrope walk. He was 90 years old by one measure, 85 and a half by another, and he still didn't know how to live. On his way out, he picked up his confidence and optimism and poured it on the carpet.
Chapter 9. Rip Tie Cut Toy Man, June 2045. Paul took the stairs down and circled the block a few times, hoping for nothing more than to forget himself for a while. He was tired of having to think about what he was every waking moment. The streets around the building were familiar enough not to let him delude himself, but at least to allow him to take himself for granted. It was hard to separate fact from rumor, but he'd heard that even the giga-rich tended to live in relatively mundane surroundings, favoring realism over power fantasies. A few models of psychotics had reportedly set up themselves as dictators in opulent palaces, waited on hand and foot, but most copies aimed for an illusion of continuity. If you desperately wanted to convince yourself that you were the same person as your memory suggested, the worst thing to do would be to swan around a virtual antiquity with modcons pretending to be Cleopatra or Ramses II. Paul didn't believe that he was his original. He knew he was nothing but a cloud of ambiguous data. The miracle was that he was capable of believing that he existed at all. What gave him that sense of identity? Continuity. Consistency. Thought following thought in a coherent pattern. But where did that coherence come from? In a human or a copy being run in the usual way, the physics of brain or computer meant that the state of mind at any one moment directly influenced the state of mind that followed. Continuity was a simple matter of cause and effect. What you thought at time A affected what you thought at time B, affected what you thought at time C. But when his subjective time was scrambled, the flow of cause and effect within the computer bore no relationship whatsoever to the flow of his experience. So how could it be an essential part of it? When the program spelt out his life DBCEA, but it still felt exactly like ABCDE, then surely the pattern was all, and cause and effect were irrelevant. The whole experience might just as well have arisen by chance. Suppose an intentionally haywire computer sat for 1,000 years or more, twitching from state to state in the sway of nothing but electrical noise. Might it embody consciousness? In real time, the answer was, probably not, the probability of any kind of coherence arising at random being so small. Real time, though, was only one possible reference frame. What about all the others? If the states the machine passed through could be rearranged in time arbitrarily, then who could say what kind of elaborate order might emerge from the chaos? Paul caught himself. Was that fatuous? As absurd as insisting that every room full of monkeys really did type the complete works of Shakespeare? They just happened to put the letters in a slightly different order? As ludicrous as claiming that every large enough quantity of rock contained Michelangelo's David, and every warehouse full of paint and canvas contained the complete works of Rembrandt and Picasso? Not in any mere latent form, awaiting some skillful forger to physically rearrange them, but solely by virtue of the potential redefinition of the coordinates of space-time? For a statue or a painting, yes, it was a joke. Where was the observer who perceived the paint to be in contact with the canvas, who saw the stone figure suitably delineated by air? If the pattern in question was not an isolated object, though, but a self-contained world, complete with at least one observer to join up the dots from within, there was no doubt that it was possible. He'd done it. In the final trial of the second experiment, he'd assembled himself and his surroundings, effortlessly, from the dust of randomly scattered moments, from apparent white noise in real time. True, what the computer had done had been contrived, guaranteed to contain his thoughts and perceptions coded into its seemingly aimless calculations. But given a large enough collection of truly random numbers, there was no reason to believe that it wouldn't include, purely by accident, hidden patterns as complex and coherent as the ones which underlay him. And wouldn't those patterns, however scrambled they might be in real time, be conscious of themselves, just as he'd been conscious, and piece their own subjective world together, just as he had done? Paul returned to the apartment, fighting off a sense of giddiness and unreality. So much for forgetting himself. He felt more charged than ever with the truth of his strange nature. Did he still want to bail out? No. No. How could he declare that he'd happily wake and forget himself, wake and reclaim his life, when he was beginning to glimpse the answers to questions which his original had never even dared to ask? Chapter 10. Remit, not paucity. November 2050. Maria arrived at the café 15 minutes early, to find Durham already there, seated at a table close to the entrance. She was surprised, but relieved. With the long wait she'd been expecting suddenly cancelled, she had no time to grow nervous. Durham spotted her as she walked in. They shook hands, exchanged pleasantries, ordered coffee from the table's touchscreen menus. Seeing Durham in the flesh did nothing to contradict the impression he'd made by phone. Middle-aged, quiet, conservatively dressed, not exactly the archetypical autoverse junkie. Maria said, "I always thought I was the only Autoverse Review subscriber living in Sydney. I've been in touch with Ian Summers in Hobart a couple of times, but I never realized there was anyone so close." Durham was apologetic. "There's no reason why you would have heard of me. I'm afraid I've always confined myself to reading the articles. I've never contributed anything or participated in the conferences. I don't actually work in the Autoverse myself. I don't have the time, or the skills, to be honest." Maria absorbed that, trying not to appear too startled. It was like hearing someone admit that they studied chess, but never played the game. "But I've followed progress in the field very closely, and I can certainly appreciate what you've done with A. Lamberti, perhaps even more so than some of your fellow practitioners. I think I see it in a rather broader context."
"You mean cellular automata in general?"
"Cellular automata, artificial life."
"They're your main interests?"
"Yes." "But not as a participant?" Maria tried to imagine this man as a patron of the artificial life scene, magnanimously sponsoring promising young practitioners. Lorenzo the Magnificent, to the Botticellis and Michelangelos of cellular automaton theory. It wouldn't wash. Even if the idea wasn't intrinsically ludicrous, he just didn't look that rich. The coffee arrived. Durham started paying for both of them, but when Maria protested, he let her pay for herself without an argument, which made her feel far more at ease. As the robot trolley slid away, she got straight to the point.
You say you're interested in funding research that builds on my results with A. Lamberti. Is there any particular direction?
Yes. I have something very specific in mind. Durham hesitated. I still don't know the best way to put this, but I want you to help me prove a point. I want you to construct a seed for a biosphere. Maria said nothing. She wasn't even sure that she'd heard him correctly. A seed for a biosphere was terraforming jargon for all the plant and animal species required to render a sterile but theoretically habitable planet ecologically stable. She'd never come across the phrase in any other context. Durham continued, I want you to design a prebiotic environment, a planetary surface, if you'd like to think of it that way, and one simple organism which you believe would be capable in time of evolving into a multitude of species and filling all the potential ecological niches. An environment? So you want a virtual reality landscape? Maria tried not to look disappointed. Had she seriously expected to be paid to work in the Autoverse? With microscopic primordial life? Some kind of Precambrian theme park where the users can shrink to the size of algae and inspect their earliest ancestors? For all her distaste for patchwork VR, Maria found herself almost warming to the idea. If Durham was offering her the chance to supervise the whole project and the funds to do the job properly, it would be 1,000 times more interesting than any of the tedious VR contracts she'd had in the past, and a lot more lucrative. But Durham said, No, please, forget about virtual reality. I want you to design an organism and an environment in the Autoverse, which would have the properties I've described. And forget about Precambrian algae. I don't expect you to recreate ancestral life on Earth, translated into Autoverse chemistry, if such a thing would even be possible. I just want you to construct a system with the same potential. Maria was now thoroughly confused.
When you mentioned a planetary surface, I thought you meant a full-scale virtual landscape, a few dozen square kilometers. But if you're talking about the Autoverse, you mean a fissure in a rock on a seabed, something like that? Something vaguely analogous to a microenvironment on the early Earth? Something a bit more natural than a culture dish full of two different sugars?
Durham said, I'm sorry, I'm not making myself very clear. Of course you'll want to try out the seed organism in a number of microenvironments. That's the only way you'll be able to predict with any confidence that it would actually survive, mutate, adapt, flourish. But once that's established, I'll want you to describe the complete picture. Specify an entire planetary environment which the Autoverse could support, and in which the seed would be likely to evolve into higher life forms. Maria hesitated. She was beginning to wonder if Durham had any idea of the scale on which things were done in the Autoverse.
What exactly do you mean by a planetary environment?
Whatever you think is reasonable. Say, 30 million square kilometers? He laughed. Don't have a heart attack. I don't expect you to model the whole thing atom by atom. I do realize that all the computers on Earth couldn't handle much more than a tide pool. I just want you to describe the essential features. You could do that in a couple of terabytes, probably less. It wouldn't take much to sum up the topography. It doesn't matter what the specific shape of every mountain and valley and beach is. All you need is a statistical description, a few relevant fractal dimensions. The meteorology and the geochemistry, for want of a better word, will be a little more complex, but I think you know what I'm getting at. You could summarize everything that matters about a prebiotic planet with a relatively small amount of data. I don't expect you to hand over a giant autoverse grid which contains every atom and every grain of sand.
Maria said, No, of course not.
This was getting stranger by the minute.
But why specify a whole planet in any form?
The size of the environment and the variation in climate and terrain are important factors. Details like that will affect the number of different species which arise in isolation and later migrate and interact. They certainly made a difference to the Earth's evolutionary history, so they may or may not be crucial, but they're hardly irrelevant.
Maria said carefully, That's true, but nobody will ever be able to run a system that big in the Autoverse, so what's the point of describing it? On Earth, the system is that big. We're stuck with it. The only way to explain the entire fossil record and the current distribution of species is to look at things on a planetary scale. Migration has happened. It has to be taken into account. But in the Autoverse, it hasn't happened, and it never will. Effects like that will always be completely hypothetical.
Durham said, Hypothetical? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean the results can't be considered, can't be imagined, can't be argued about. Think of this whole project as an aid to a thought experiment, a sketch of a proof.
A proof of what?
That Autoverse life could, in theory, be as rich and complex as life on Earth.
Maria shook her head. I can't prove that. Modeling a few thousand generations of bacterial evolution in a few microenvironments...
Durham waved a hand reassuringly. Don't worry. I don't have unrealistic expectations. I said a sketch of a proof, but maybe even that's putting it too strongly. I just want suggestive evidence. I want the best blueprint, the best recipe you can come up with for a world embedded in the Autoverse, which might eventually develop complex life. A set of results on the short-term evolutionary genetics of the seed organism, plus an outline of an environment in which that organism could, plausibly, evolve into higher forms. It's impossible to run a planet-sized world, but that's no reason not to contemplate what such a world would be like, to answer as many questions as can be answered, and to make the whole scenario as concrete as possible. I want you to create a package so thorough, so detailed, that if someone handed it to you out of the blue, it would be enough, not to prove anything, but to persuade you that true biological diversity could arise in the Autoverse.
Maria laughed. I'm already persuaded of that myself. I just doubt that there could ever be a watertight proof.
Then imagine persuading someone a little more skeptical.
Who exactly do you have in mind? Calvin and his mob?
If you like. Maria suddenly wondered if Durham was someone she should have known after all. Someone who'd published in other areas of the artificial life scene. Why else would he be concerned with that debate? She should have done a much wider literature search.
She said, So what it comes down to is, you want to present the strongest possible case that deterministic systems like the Autoverse can generate a biology as complex as real-world biology, that all the subtleties of real-world physics and quantum indeterminacy aren't essential, and to deal with the objection that a complex biology might only arise in a complex environment, you want a description of a suitable planet that could exist in the Autoverse, if not for the minor inconvenience that the hardware that could run it will almost certainly never be built.
That's right. Maria hesitated. She didn't want to argue this bizarre project out of existence, but she could hardly take it on if she wasn't clear about its goals.
But when it's all said and done, how much will this really add to the results with A. Lamberti?
In one sense, not a lot, Durham conceded. As you said, there can never be a proof. Natural selection is natural selection, and you've shown that it can happen in the Autoverse. Maybe that should be enough.
But don't you think a carefully designed thought experiment with an entire planet is a bit more evocative than any number of real experiments with petri dishes? Don't underestimate the need to appeal to people's imaginations. Maybe you can see all the consequences of your work already. Other people might need to have them spelt out explicitly.
Maria couldn't argue with any of that, but who handed out research grants on the basis of what was evocative? So, which university? Durham cut her off. I'm not an academic. This is just an interest of mine, a hobby, like it is with you. I'm an insurance salesman, in real life. But how could you get funding without... I'm paying for this myself, he laughed. Don't worry, I can afford it. If you take me up on this, you're not going to be shortchanged, I can promise you that. And I know, it's unusual for an amateur to subcontract. But like I said, I don't work in the Autoverse. It would take me 5 years to learn to do myself what I'm asking of you. You'll be free to publish all of this under your own name, of course. All I ask is a footnote acknowledging financial support. Maria didn't know what to say. Lorenzo, the insurance salesman, a private citizen, not even an Autoverse junkie, was offering to pay her to carry out the most abstract piece of programming imaginable. Not simulating a non-existent world, but preparing a simulation that would never be performed. She could hardly be disdainful of anyone for throwing their hard-earned money away on pointless Autoverse research, but everything that had driven her to do that herself revolved around first-hand experience. However much intellectual pleasure it had given her, the real obsession, the real addiction, was a matter of putting on the gloves and reaching into that artificial space. Durham handed her a ROM chip. There are some detailed notes here, including a few ideas of mine, but don't feel obliged to follow any of them. What I want is whatever you think is most likely to work, not what's closest to my preconceptions. And there's a contract, of course. Have your legal expert system look it over. If you're not happy with anything, I'm pretty flexible.
Thank you.
Durham stood. I'm sorry to cut this short, but I'm afraid I have another appointment. Please, read the notes, think it all through. Call me when you've made a decision. After he'd left, Maria sat at the table, staring at the black epoxy rectangle in her palm, trying to make sense of what had happened. Babbage had designed the analytical engine with no real prospect of seeing it constructed in his lifetime. Space travel enthusiasts had been designing interstellar craft down to every last nut and bolt since the 1960s. Terraforming advocates were constantly churning out comprehensive feasibility studies for schemes unlikely to be attempted for 100 years or more. Why? As aids to thought experiments, as sketches of proofs. And if Durham, who'd never even worked in the Autoverse, had an infinitely grander vision of its long-term possibilities than she had, then maybe she'd always been too close to it, too wrapped up in the tedious contingencies to see what he'd seen. Except that this wasn't about long-term possibilities. The computer that could run an Autoverse world would be far bigger than the planet it was modeling. If such a device was ever to be constructed, however far into the future, there'd have to be far better reasons for building it than this. It wasn't a question of a visionary born a generation or two before his time. Autoverse ecology was an entirely theoretical notion, and it always would be. The project was a thought experiment in the purest sense. It was also too good to be true. The Autoverse addict's dream contract. But short of some senseless, capricious hoax, why should Durham lie to her? Maria pocketed the chip and left the cafe, not knowing whether to feel skeptical and pessimistic, or elated and guilty. Guilty, because Durham, if he was genuine, if he honestly planned to pay her real money for this glorious senseless exercise, had to be a little insane. If she took this job, she'd be taking advantage of him, exploiting his strange madness. Maria let Aiden into the house reluctantly. They usually met at his place, or on neutral ground, but he'd been visiting a friend nearby, and she could think of no excuse to turn him away. She caught a glimpse of the red cloudless sunset behind him, and the open doorway let in the hot concrete smell of dusk, the whir of evening traffic. After 7 hours cloistered in her room, reading Durham's notes for his Autoverse Garden of Eden, the street outside seemed strange, almost shocking, charged with the 2 billion-year gulf between Earth's equivalent moment of primordial fecundity and all the bizarre consequences. She walked ahead of Aiden, down the entrance hall, and switched on the light in the living room while he propped his cycle against the stairs. Alone, the house suited her perfectly, but it took only one more person to make it seem cramped. He caught up with her and said,
"I heard about your mother."
"How? Who told you?"
"Joe knows one of your cousins in Newcastle. Angela? Is that her name?"
He was leaning sideways against the doorframe, arms folded. Maria said,
"Why don't you come right in if you're coming in?"
He said,
"I'm sorry. Is there anything I can do?"
She shook her head. She'd been planning to ask him how much he could lend her to help with the scan, but she couldn't raise the subject. Not yet. He'd ask innocently if Francesca was certain that she wanted to be scanned, and the whole thing would degenerate into an argument about her right to choose a natural death, as if there was any real choice without the money for a scan. Maria said,
"I saw her yesterday. She's handling it pretty well, but I don't want to talk about it right now."
Aiden nodded, then detached himself from the doorway and walked up to her. They kissed for a while, which was comforting in a way, but Aiden soon had an erection, and Maria was in no mood for sex. Even at the best of times, it took a willing suspension of disbelief, a conscious decision to bury her awareness of the biological clockwork driving her emotions. And right now, her head was still buzzing with Durham's suggestion for building a kind of latent diploidism into A. Lamberti, a propensity to mistakenly make extra copies of chromosomes, which might eventually pave the way to sexual reproduction and all of its evolutionary advantages. Aiden pulled free and went and sat in one of the armchairs. Maria said,
"I think I finally got some work, if I didn't dream the whole thing."
"That's great. Who for?"
She described her meeting with Durham, the commission, the seed. Aiden said,
"So you don't even know what he gets out of this, except not quite proving some obscure intellectual point about evolution."
He laughed incredulous.
"How will you know if you've not quite proved it well enough? And what if Durham disagrees?"
"The contract is all in my favor. He pays the money into a trust fund before I even start. All I have to do is make a genuine effort to complete the project within 6 months. And if there's any dispute, he's legally bound to accept an independent adjudicator's decision on what constitutes a genuine effort. The expert system I hired gave the contract a AAA rating."
Aiden still looked skeptical.
"You should get a second opinion. Half the time those things don't even agree with each other, let alone predict what would happen in court. Anyway, if it all goes smoothly, what do you end up with?"
$30,000. Not bad for 6 months' work, plus computing time up to another $30,000, billed directly to him.
"Yeah? How can he afford all this?"
"He's an insurance salesman. If he's good, he could be making, I don't know, $200,000 a year."
"Which is $120,000 after tax. And he's paying out $60,000 on this shit?"
"Yes. You have a problem with that? It doesn't exactly leave him poverty-stricken. And he could be earning twice as much for all I know. Not to mention savings, investments, tax dodges. His personal finances are none of my business. Once the money's in the trust fund, he can go bankrupt for all I care. I still get paid if I finish the job. That's good enough for me."
Aiden shook his head.
"I just can't see why he thinks it's worth it. There are God knows how many thousand copies in existence, right now, running half the biggest corporations in the world, in case you hadn't noticed. And this man wants to spend $60,000 proving that artificial life can go beyond bacteria."
Maria groaned.
"We've been through this before. The Autoverse is not virtual reality. Copies are not the human equivalent of A. Lamberti. They're a cheat. They're a mess. They do what they're meant to do very efficiently. But there's no underlying logic to them. Every part of their body obeys a different set of ad hoc rules." Okay, it would be insane to try to model an entire human body on a molecular level, but if you're interested in the way fundamental physics affects biology, copies are irrelevant because they have no fundamental physics. The behavior of a copy's neurons doesn't arise from any deeper laws. It's just a matter of some rules for neurons, which are based directly on what's known about neurons in the human body. But in the human body, that behavior is a consequence of the laws of physics, acting on billions of molecules. With copies, we've cheated, for the sake of efficiency. There are no molecules, and no laws of physics. We've just put in the net results, the biology, by hand.
And that offends your aesthetic sensibilities.
That's not the point. Copies have their place, and when the time comes, I'd rather be a software mongrel than dead. All I'm saying is, they're useless for telling you what kind of physics can support what kind of life.
A burning question of our time.
Maria felt herself flush with anger, but she said evenly,
Maybe not. I just happen to find it interesting. And apparently Paul Durham does too. And maybe it's too abstract a question to qualify as science. Maybe working in the autoverse is nothing but pure mathematics, or philosophy, or art. But you don't seem to have any qualms about spending a year in Seoul practicing your own useless art form at the Korean taxpayers' expense.
It's a private university.
Korean students' expense, then.
I never said there was anything wrong with you taking the job. I just don't want to see you get screwed if this man turns out to be lying.
What could he possibly have to gain by lying?
I don't know, but I still don't see what he has to gain if he's telling the truth.
He shrugged.
But if you're happy, I'm happy. Maybe it'll all be okay. And I know, the way things are going, you can't afford to be picky.
Picky? Maria started laughing. Discussing this on Aiden's terms was ridiculous. Durham wasn't stringing her along, wasting her time. He was absolutely serious. His notes prove that. 300 pages, months of work. He'd taken the plan as far as he could, short of learning the intricacies of the Autoverse himself. And maybe she still didn't understand his motives, but maybe there was nothing to be understood. When she'd been immersed in his notes, there'd been no mystery at all. On its own terms, Durham's plan was natural, obvious. An end in itself, requiring no dreary explanation rooted in the world of academic glory and monetary gain. Aiden said,
What's so funny?
Never mind.
He shifted in the chair and looked at her oddly.
Well, at least you won't have to spend all your time in Seoul looking for work now. That would have been a bore.
I'm not going to Seoul.
You're joking.
She shook her head.
What's the problem? You can do this job anywhere, can't you?
Probably, yes.
Maria felt a twinge of uncertainty. He seemed genuinely hurt. He'd made it clear that he'd go without her, if he had to. But that was understandable. Composer in residence was his perfect job, and she had nothing to weigh against that, nothing to lose by accompanying him. He might have put his position more diplomatically, instead of making her feel like optional baggage, but that was neither proof that he was trying to drive her away, nor an unforgivable crime in itself. He was tactless sometimes. She could live with that.
What's wrong with you? You'd love it in Seoul. You know you would.
She said,
I'd love it too much. There'd be too many distractions. This project is going to be hard work, the hardest thing I've ever done, and if I can't give it all my attention, it's going to be impossible.
It had started as an ad lib excuse, but it was true. She had 6 months, if not to build a world, at least to sketch one. If she didn't eat, sleep, and breathe it, it would never come together. It would never come to life. Aiden snorted.
That's ludicrous. You don't even have to write a program that runs. You said it yourself. As long as you make a reasonable effort, whatever you hand over will be good enough. What's Durham gonna say? Sorry, but I don't think this slime mold would ever invent the wheel.
Getting it right matters to me.
Aiden said nothing. Then,
if you want to stay behind because of your mother, why can't you just say so?
Maria was startled.
because it's not true.
He stared at her angrily.
You know, I was going to offer to stay here with you, but you didn't want to talk about it.
Maria untangled that.